Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2020 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
Today on Valley Edition, we're going to tell you about an unprecedented collaboration among California newsrooms that aims to shine a light on police misconduct.
And later, a panel in honor of Women's History Month. We'll ask three millennial leaders in the Central Valley about the women who inspire and motivate them.
But first, we're going to take you to Tulare County, to the largest olive-growing region in California. In fact, more than half of California olives are harvested right here in the San Joaquin Valley.
You know, you walk through this orchard and you look at the size of the trunks on these trees. They're 65 years old. They've been managed as a commercial orchard for all those years.
That's olive grower Jim Simons. He and other farmers are scrambling to figure out what to do with an anticipated bumper crop this year in the face of what they say is devastating news. One of the two canneries in California, Bell Carter, has just terminated its contracts with most of its growers. It turns out it's cheaper for Bell Carter to import unprocessed olives from Spain, where the crop is subsidized, than to buy them locally. The California Olive Growers Council says unless legislators help them find a solution, some growers could lose their farms. I spoke with Jim Simons from his olive grove near Visalia.
Based on what we know with the production history here, this is the on year. The bloom looks very strong. You can see it on the trees. You can see the prior year shoot growth that is the new bloom bud wood, and there's a lot of it. So naturally, we would be optimistic about having a good crop this coming season, except for with a letter from the Bell Carter Olive Company, we now have no contract to deliver the fruit, and we don't know where we stand. The industry as a whole is in a great deal of turmoil right now. The California olive industry as a whole, I think, is actually on the line. I don't know that the California olive industry as a whole can survive what Bell Carter is doing with a foreign national Spanish olive company.
So tell me, what is Bell Carter doing?
Basically, what happened the first day of March, which is when the contract renewal window opens, Bell Carter released essentially 2/3 of their growers in the state, which is about 6,000 acres. Just driving out to the ranch to meet with you today, you know, every orchard just about that I drove by is now out of contract, and we'll have to either look to some remediation, and I'm not sure what that looks like right now.
So what are growers going to do this year?
Well, the other 6,000 acres that Bell Carter didn't have essentially are under contract with the Musco Family Olive Company. There is a possibility, and it's a remote possibility, that a few growers can be absorbed into that business. But they're going to have to be awfully careful because they know what Bell Carter's doing. They know that foreign fruit is going to come in under market price.
So what does this mean for you as a grower who's part of generations of olive growers?
Well, my grandfather's father planted olive trees in 1910 over in the town of Woodlake. And my grandkids have been out here driving forklifts, harvest tractors. Now, you know, they sit between your leg, and it's probably not OSHA approved, but that's how you train kids out here. What's it mean? It means that we'll see if there's any legislative relief. We'll see if there's something about this deal that Bell Carter has made with a multinational to bring in foreign fruit to displace the California growers. If there's something about that doesn't pass muster, that's way above my pay grade as far as what I would be able to say about it. It's certainly not ethical, but it it's possible that it's legal. And if it's legal, then we probably need to take a look at that. It's better to grow your own food. It's a good thing to be self-sufficient. And the Central San Joaquin Valley is kind of the heartbeat of where it all comes from. What does it mean? If there's no remediation, gosh, that's a beautiful tree for landscape. I'll sell a few for landscaping, but with 6,000 acres of trees on the market, there's not much upside there.
Well, what will growers do with all of these olives this year if the other canning company can't take them?
Well, we're fortunate in the regards both that it was a wet winter generally. Specifically, I won't need to spend any money irrigating these trees for probably another 2 months. There's plenty of ground moisture. We can run out the clock for 60, 70 days probably and wait and see if there's a chance that we could be picked up by the other cannery, see if there's remediation that might legislate some sort of a phase into this deal that they've got cooked up. I would say that, you know, if they said, well, look, we're not going to survive, we're going to make a deal with a multinational, you have 3 years of contract, start making your plans. That would have been something. Specifically, if there's no home for the fruit, we'll do an evaluation when we have to start spending a lot of money with irrigation and pruning and fertilizer and et cetera.
You've got pistachio trees to the
south
of you and orange trees to the east of you. So what are you thinking? Are you eyeing these trees and wondering if that's what you're going to do next?
Well, I mean, you can't sit on your hands and wait forever. If you're not going to be in the olive business, you want to have trees going in the ground by next spring, a year out. So you got a lot of work to do. These trees have got to be. I mean, look at the trunk on that tree. How would you like to? That tree as a specimen in somebody's yard would probably land for about $5,000. It's beautiful, the way the convolutions on that tree, the shape of the tree, and so on. Generally speaking, we have to wait and see if there's any options. You can't just walk away today. It's too soon.
And how long has your family had a contract with Bell Carter?
I think we were looking at that. I think it's well over 20 years. We were part of the Lindsay Olive Growers Co-op as a family operation that closed its doors. Bell Carter bought the labels, the old Lindsay label. That was the icon of the industry. Lindsay and Early California, both those canneries were here, one in Visalia, one in Lindsay. Those are both gone because of the environmental restrictions on processing the olives. Makes it virtually impossible for those 6,000 acres that I was speaking of to form a new company. The environmental impacts of getting an olive cannery going these days, it's just not something that can happen. Musco has a very state-of-the-art plant.
So tell me a little bit about the history of olive growing in Tulare County. Why is it one of the most abundant areas in California?
Well, the Central San Joaquin Valley and the Sacramento Valley, for that matter, Mediterranean climates. Olives love Mediterranean climates. They love a nice, hot, long summer, and they like a chilly, cool winter, not bitter, freezing cold, but they like a dormancy. And everything that we have here is just perfect for California table olive production.
People who know Lindsay think of Lindsay olives, and we see those in grocery stores. Will we still be seeing those?
Oh, absolutely.
But they just won't be from California?
The likelihood of Spanish olives getting into that Lindsay, that old Lindsay ripe label, is very high. And as a matter of fact, I don't see how, if this deal goes forward, that won't happen. Now, whether they're called foreign fruit or whether they're called California because they were actually processed here in California, again, that's a little above my pay grade, but I know that they're thinking that they can call it California. And it won't be California field product. It'll be Spanish field product.
I reached out for an interview with Bell Carter and received a company statement from the CEO. Tim Carter says, while the decision is extremely difficult for us and for our many grower partners dating back three generations, it is imperative to remain competitive and viable.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. For months, it's been unclear if the Mesa Verde detention facility in Bakersfield would stay open. There's a state law that many thought would shutter the facility after its contract with the local government was set to expire today. Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez is here to tell us why that isn't happening. So, Monica, ICE recently released a statement saying Mesa Verde will stay open at least for another year. What's going on here?
Yeah, so the company that runs Mesa Verde, the GEO Group, they had a contract with the city of McFarland and ICE to run this facility. But McFarland pulled out of that agreement in December, and the contract is set to expire today, actually. So instead, ICE is directly contracting with the GEO Group, citing what they call unusual and compelling urgency. And so because of that, ICE doesn't have to go through what is called a competitive bidding process. So federal law requires government agencies to have a period where companies can bid for these contracts, and it's a way to make this process more transparent and more fair. But ICE is able to go around that process for now because of the unusual and compelling urgency that they're citing.
So, okay, they're saying unusual and compelling urgency is why Mesa Verde needs to stay open for now. What about this situation for them is unusual and compelling?
Yeah, that's what it looks like for now. So a competitive bidding process, this takes time. And in these documents that I submitted, they're explaining why they don't have time for this process and need Mesa Verde to stay open in the meantime. So ICE says if Mesa Verde were to close, the 400 people inside would have to be transferred. And they're also saying that some of these detainees, they have medical conditions, and if they had to be transferred, it could result in what they called serious injuries. And so ICE also says transferring all these people would be an unnecessary, serious financial burden.
What about SB 29, that state law that's supposed to limit collaboration between ICE and local government and also law enforcement? Shouldn't that have stopped Mesa Verde from continuing to operate? I mean, doesn't the GEO Group need to have a contract with a local government agency?
No, the GEO Group doesn't necessarily need to have a contract with a local agency. That's one way to do it. But SB 29 stops any city, county, or local law enforcement agency from going into new contracts with for-profit detention facilities like Mesa Verde. So SB 29 doesn't stop for-profit facilities and ICE from contracting with each other. So in this case, it seems ICE and the GEO Group still found a way to contract with each other.
What ICE is doing, are you saying it's still completely legal?
That's more complicated, and it gets really murky here because, so I talked to Liz Martinez, and she's the director of advocacy and communications at Freedom for Immigrants, and that organization, they helped draft SB 29. She says the legality of this is unclear, you know, because of the unusual and compelling urgency that they're citing.
What is that unusual and compelling urgency? The only urgency that we see is that they're just trying to push the administration's anti-immigrant agenda and line the pockets of private prison companies. It has nothing to do, you know, with the well-being of the individuals detained inside. And which was interesting because ICE even went as far as to say that relocating individuals would have resulted in, quote, serious injury to those individuals with serious medical conditions when the facility itself was found to be deficient in regards to medical care, according to ICE's own Office of Detention Oversight. So that argument does not hold because if they truly cared about the well-being of detained individuals, they would have released them a long time ago.
It's also important to note that Mesa Verde didn't look so good in the Attorney General's report on immigration detention facilities that was released last month. So in the report, it found Mesa Verde was only compliant with 4 out of the 16 national detention standards. And they found, you know, deficiencies in food service, medical care and phone access.
What does ICE or the GEO Group have to say about all of this?
The GEO Group, they referred me to ICE when I reached out to them for comment. And ICE only gave out a statement that said that they don't want to disrupt the operations going on at Mesa Verde right now. And they don't want to have to relocate all of these people detained inside. And this contract is a $19 million contract, and it's set to expire a year from now.
Monica Velez covers immigration here at Valley Public Radio. Thanks for keeping us up to date on all of this.
A recent law, SB 1421, requires police departments to make public internal investigation records regarding officers' use of force, sexual misconduct, and lying on reports. Now news agencies statewide, including Valley Public Radio, are collaborating to access and report on these records. I spoke with Alex Emsley, a criminal justice reporter at KQED, who helped spearhead the project. So, Alex, how did this project get started?
Well, you know, for me, it goes back to a few actually previous attempts to change this law that didn't work out. And then, you know, this year, late summer going into fall, the law suddenly looked like it was going to change. And people in California would, for the first time in decades, depending on how you parse the records, get a look, a window into how police departments handle serious kinds of misconduct and how they investigate uses of deadly force, including police shootings. And, you know, like I said, that was kind of getting toward the end of last year. And I was suddenly in a position as a criminal justice reporter with a lot of Public Records Act experience where I felt like I could do nothing other than to try to request as many of these records as possible. I actually tried to hedge that a little bit, but my colleague, Suki Lewis at KQED, really pushed to say, why don't we create a collaboration? Why don't we get a bunch of news organizations together throughout the state and really go after these records once they become open on January 1st of this year?
And how many records have you acquired so far?
You know, as of right now, I can say that it just the couple of news organizations that KQED has been working with most closely in Northern California, we've gotten some kind of a response from close to 100 different agencies. Now, we've sent public records requests to more than 400. So just as kind of a rough estimate, maybe you could say we've gotten about a quarter back. Responses that range a bit of a spectrum from, you know, full-on case files, body camera video, audio of internal affairs investigations, to very brief sort of synopses or indexes of cases where then in most of the time we're going back and seeking more.
And how much resistance have you had from police agencies?
Well, you know, that also is pretty varied, right? I mean, some just turn the records over right away. In fact, a lot more quickly than I would have ever expected. Others are, you know, in some kind of litigation. Now, let me step back from that for a second and say, you know, no cities have sued to stop these records from coming out. The cities are being sued by law enforcement unions in every case that I'm aware of, saying, city, you know, before you release these records, we want to challenge your legal ability to do so. And so those cases, there's, you know, dozens, I'm sorry, there's at least a dozen across the state, have really slowed down the release of records in the jurisdictions, in the counties where those cases have been brought. And then there's sort of another ring of that, a little bit broader, where agencies are saying, well, we're not ourselves being sued, but we could be. So we want to wait until the courts make a ruling on whether or not we have to release these records under this law before we do so. That together, those sort of different positions together, you know, we're over 100 agencies have claimed some sort of either they're in a lawsuit that doesn't allow them to release the records, or they want to wait for other lawsuits before they start releasing them. So that has been kind of the biggest holdup.
And has California been one of the more secretive states when it comes to police misconduct records?
Yes. And again, depending on who you ask, it's either the most secretive or one of the most secretive. I've been a journalist and a criminal justice reporter in California the whole time that I've been doing that work. So for me, it's just always been, you know, that was the sort of state of things. That was the state of the law, is if you wanted to know anything about police department administrative discipline, about when an officer, maybe they're not charged with a crime, but that they were found by their own department to have done something wrong, you just couldn't. There was just no avenues to be able to pry those records loose from any police departments throughout the state. And if you happened to get one, you got one, it would be illegal for you to get it. It would be illegal for a police agency to release those documents. And then all of a sudden on January 1st, it's just like major change. We can get, and again, it's not everything, but some of the most serious types of misconduct and, you know, use of deadly force, whether it be misconduct or just, you know, a justified police shooting, legally justified police shooting, we now can get tons of records about.
And one last question. How do you think this will change the way Californians look at police misconduct?
I think it's going to be difficult to tell because you don't know, because Californians have never gotten sort of a comprehensive look at this before. So I think the first step is, and this is really on journalists and why we've built this coalition, I believe, is to collect the data, present the picture to the public, serve as a conduit for that kind of thing to the public, and then let them evaluate it and see what they think. I can say that we've already, you know, in cases that we've reported on, seen sort of a miscommunication between law enforcement agencies who are finding potential criminal conduct on the part of officers that they're doing disciplinary investigations into, but we're not seeing a lot of charges filed by prosecutors in those cases. So it's a very small sample size at this point, but if that trend sort of continues to hold as we get more of those records, then I think that that's something that the public is going to be very interested in, to see sort of where do balls get dropped? Where are people in a certain profession may be treated differently in the criminal justice system than others might be.
That was Alex Emsley, a reporter at KQED.
You've likely heard of the argument, fish versus farms, that farmers feel slighted that they have to fight for water allocations with endangered fish. Now that fight is playing out in Washington, D.C., where the Trump administration has fast-tracked a process to deliver more water to farms. But an investigation by KQED reveals those changes are raising alarm among federal employees. To learn more, FM89's Carrie Klein interviewed KQED science reporter Lauren Summer.
What it has to do with is these rules that govern this very important water infrastructure in California. I mean, water travels hundreds of miles in this state, you know, all the way up from Shasta Dam, all the way down to San Diego. But one of the key pieces of infrastructure is in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, and it's these massive pumping plants. And there are rules that govern these plants because these plants are so powerful, they actually can harm endangered fish like endangered salmon and Delta smelt. And right now, the Trump administration is in the process of rewriting those rules, which will affect how much water makes it to the San Joaquin Valley and how much water stays in the ecosystem for the fish.
And at the center of this story that you wrote is a biological assessment that was released in early February. And then the Trump administration has given federal scientists very little time to review the assessment. And that will impact how much water farmers get.
Yeah, I mean, here's how it works. The Bureau of Reclamation writes this biological assessment. It's basically their idea about how they want to run the pumps and all the dams and water infrastructure and how much water they want to supply to their contractors, many of which are in the Central Valley. So that biological assessment came out. It said they want to increase the annual water flow, the annual water supply by about 500,000 acre feet, which is like it can be 10 to 15% depending on the type of year. But what happens now is that federal biologists actually have to look at this plan and evaluate, is it going to hurt fish or is it going to help them? If it's going to actually jeopardize the existence of these fish and make them go extinct, then these federal wildlife biologists have to kind of rewrite the rules. And so that's what's happening right now is these federal biologists are looking at the rules. But President Trump last fall put out a memo very specifically about this decision, saying that those federal biologists had 135 days to do that very complex analysis. Now, last time this was done 10 years ago, it took much longer, 80% longer to do it. So that's raised some concerns about whether or not these biologists have enough time to really do a thorough job.
Yeah, and so what are the concerns that you're seeing, hearing, reading about, and how did you find them?
Yeah, so I put in a Freedom of Information Act request and I got some emails from these federal biologists that actually have to look at these rules for salmon and for some other fish species. They raised some flags. They were saying, you know, one, they didn't have the staff and resources to do this review. that was even before this timeline was sped up by President Trump. So they were worried that they didn't have all the people that they needed to actually do it. They were a bit worried that the Bureau of Reclamation was kind of tipping in favor of water supply as opposed to endangered fish, that in cases maybe where the science isn't exactly clear what the fish need, that the Bureau of Reclamation was pushing in favor of water supply. You know, a number of kind of flags that were also raised have to do with the public and scientific review. When these rules were done 10 years ago, the wildlife agencies put them out for independent scientific review with an outside group of scientists that looked at the science and kind of weighed in. Through that process, the public could actually get involved. They could go to these public meetings and kind of see what was going on and what these independent scientists thought. And this timeline right now is so aggressive that the wildlife agencies, they don't have the time to do this full review like last time. They may get a few outside scientists to weigh in, but it won't be publicly accessible. So, you know, that's kind of raised another concern because these rules are very controversial. They're very important to many people in this state. And, you know, I think a lot of people want to make sure that a thorough job is done.
Right. And so a lot of these emails that you're seeing, they're revealing that people feel that the Trump administration is really cutting corners here in this whole process.
Yeah. I mean, certainly like there's a lot of perspectives on this. There are people that rely on this water that want to see these decisions made really quickly. And that's totally understandable. But I think the tension is that there's going to be lawsuits over these rules no matter what. That's what happened last time that these pumping rules kind of came out. And what these lawsuits do is they try to show that the government hasn't done a thorough job. And if these people can prove that in court, that means these rules have to be rewritten again. So, you know, certainly there are people arguing that these are important decisions that need to be made quickly, but having a thorough scientific review makes it a lot more likely that these rules will stand up in court. So that's at least why it's in the federal government's best interest to make sure that they do a good job in the first place.
And of course, another added wrinkle here is that the acting Secretary of the Interior, David Bernhardt, used to be a lawyer for Westlands Water District, which is the biggest irrigation district in the country that's poised to benefit most from increased water allocations here as well.
Yeah, certainly critics of Bernhardt have been very aggressive in pointing this out, that they feel he's had a very close relationship, obviously, with Westlands Water District. You know, he, as an attorney for them, he led the legal challenge against these pumping rules that we've just been talking about. So he was leading the legal defense to kind of take them apart. So there are people that are concerned that now that he's in charge of two of the agencies that are writing these rules, that relationship is going to show up in the final rules. The New York Times has certainly reported that he's been personally involved in kind of directing some of this stuff, even though he was at the time under federal ethics rules not to lobby on this issue. And, you know, a lot of people are kind of waiting to see what these federal biologists kind of come up with in the final version of these rules, which would probably be out in about mid-June.
So when it comes to this discussion of fish versus farms, I mean, growers on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley have been allocated 55% of the total water in their contract. That's up from the 35% announced last month. But still, a lot of growers are angry about their allocations. And I imagine if they're hearing this, many are saying, yeah, agriculture should get preference for water over fish in the Delta.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of the perennial tension, right, about water in California, is how to balance all of these needs. Because, yes, there's thousands and thousands of jobs that depend on this water. And these fish, you know, are at risk of going extinct. So this is kind of just the crux of what we fight over in this state. But there are a lot of other things going on, too. I just want to flag at a big high-level policy kind of angle. You know, one other thing that's going on is there's these voluntary settlement agreements going. I know it sounds like very wonky and technical, but essentially you've got a lot of different people involved with the Delta that need water from the Delta doing negotiations right now about how to share water better. This is because the State Water Board is putting together a new plan for how water should flow through the Delta. We already saw that happen on the San Joaquin River. The state is continuing that process for the Sacramento side of things and the Delta. And so all these water districts are kind of negotiating now about how do we share water better when people are out of water? How do some people give up water? How are they compensated for that water? So, you know, just to flag that there's a lot of moving processes happening right now. There are some very important conversations beyond these pumping rules that really could affect how water is shared in this state. A lot of people are very hopeful that there's going to be something really productive that comes out of this.
KQED science reporter Lauren Sommer, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
The 29th Annual City Jazz Festival takes place this week at Fresno City College, with a concert on Thursday featuring guest artist, pianist and composer Josh Nelson. Valley Public Radio's David Aus spoke with Nelson about his performance at City Jazz, as well as his work with vocalist and his multimedia discovery project.
One of the great things about the City Jazz Festival is its focus on education. Over the course of 2 days, young student performers from across the valley get to come together and perform and get feedback from terrific professional adjudicators. So, Josh, I'd like to ask you about your beginnings in music education. How did you get started playing the piano?
I was the benefit of very artistic-minded parents and grandparents, and I would hope that anyone getting into any part of the arts would have that luxury. I started lessons when I was 8 years old, and my grandpa introduced me to Leonard Bernstein, Andre Previn, Oscar Peterson, folks like that. And then my parents were involved in local community theater in the San Fernando Valley, LA. So I got into musical theater as an actor as well, in addition to playing for some shows. Got to playing trumpet at age 11, and trumpet really became kind of a focus for me through junior high and high school, as was piano. I really thought I was going to become a trumpet player, but piano ended up winning out. I had some great teachers, great private piano teachers, some local band directors. Someone that will be part of the Fresno Fest is a great educator, great person, Gary Pratt from Cal State Northridge. Great teachers, great parents, and all that. That seemed to push me right along. And just a self-awareness and a self-motivated approach to life. I mean, I've always just had this kind of self-starting kind of attitude about things, which has led me into other realms of music and to experiment with the Discovery Project. My main piano teacher was Cecilia Coleman, a fantastic musician and composer. She taught at Long Beach State for many years, lives in New York, and she really introduced me to the jazz piano world. She's a huge influence on me.
How did you make the transition from student to performing student to professional performer?
You know, I just kind of got on the scene in LA as soon as I could. It actually meant that I was interrupting my bachelor's degree at Long Beach State to do so. I took a couple years off. About 3 years into my bachelor's, I realized I hadn't attended to any or very little of my general education requirements for the degree. So I just went to Valley College in LA and loosely worked on my GEs, but at the same time I was getting onto the scene, just building my musical chops in every way and being open to lots of different musical settings, not just jazz. I was lucky to get called by vocalist Sarah Gazarek back in 2003 to be in her band. And so I helped her build her show, her original book, and got into arranging with her. So not everyone necessarily has a Sarah that approaches them. So I felt really lucky to have a young talent kind of take me on as she was developing, as I was developing, and work alongside her.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.
That was pianist and composer Josh Nelson with vocalist Sarah Gazarek from their album Dream in the Blue on Josh's Steelbird Music record label. Josh Nelson is the guest this week at Fresno City College's City Jazz Fest. Josh, another vocalist you've worked with is Natalie Cole. Would you talk a little bit about that experience?
An unforgettable experience, pardon the pun.
Yes.
Couldn't help myself. I worked with Natalie for 6+ years. I was her last pianist. I originally got the call for the gig from a good friend, great bassist John Belzegai. She asked him who he'd recommend when her longtime pianist Terry Trotter retired, and he recommended me. I got the call, and I got the gig. It was as simple as that. I owe Natalie a lot. I learned how to further hone and refine my chops as an accompanist, not just in jazz, but also in her R&B soul kind of, you know, the other right. music that that world of hers that I really didn't know much about. I felt like I was getting a twofer in a way because I felt like I was getting the benefit of her dad's music. So I just felt like I was in a way getting to know him in addition to her music, which really was, you know, rock. She was a rocker, rock and roll. That if you asked her, that would be what she would tell you. As much as she was a jazz singer, that part of her musicianship was very strong. And she really loved that part of it. And I went all over the world with her. It was a fantastic time. Some great, great moments with her. Lucky to get that gig.
Oh, yeah. So what's as a pianist and as an instrumentalist in general, what's the most important thing you've learned from working with vocalists? And what would you want other instrumentalists, especially student instrumentalists, to know about working with vocalists?
Oh, that's great. Great question. I'd say use your ears. Listen as much as possible and doing it as much as possible. You know, I never started out thinking I'd have all the answers. You have to be able to address the piano as a supportive instrument, no matter what the genre. That means also listening to music outside of jazz and honing your chops and your ears in that regard. Moving into the R&B world and moving into some classical music and just taking all of that and using it in the moment. And it takes time. Like I said, it takes years of doing it. I'm 40 now. I'll never be done learning. Every opportunity is a blessing, an opportunity to learn music, to further get better at it. And I'm asking singers all the time what they need and what worked and what didn't after we've done a show. And I'm constantly surprised. So just being open, you know, ears, heart, and all that.
You mentioned earlier the Discovery Project, and we just talked about being open to other genres of music. Discovery Project's about being open to and incorporating actively other genres of the arts as well in a kind of mixed media environment. Can you talk about the Discovery Project?
Yeah, it's an ongoing kind of multimedia immersive audience experience is how we like to call it. It's a team of myself, a video artist, Travis Flournoy, and then two other artists, Jesse Ottinger and Claudia Carbiata. Jesse's an architect. Claudia is a visual artist. It was born at the Blue Whale, our famous jazz club here in Los Angeles that is allowing artists to stretch and experiment. First show was in 2011, so we've been doing it for nearly 8 years now. We try and present interesting shows for different audiences based on site-specific curating of the space. Themes ranging from early science fiction and cinema and literature. That's one show called Discoveries. And then the second one is about planet Mars, exploring Mars. So I wrote music for all the rovers doing science, and I incorporated Gustav Holst's Mars, The Bringer of War from the Planets, and I read a little Ray Bradbury, Martian Chronicles. And then the third one, a little tribute to my hometown of Los Angeles, looking at the past, present, and future of LA through songs, history about the people and places, current issues such as droughts and floods, transportation in the city. And then the new show is kind of a hodgepodge of themes ranging from philosophy, science, the Hollywood rat race kind of theme. So anyway, we jump all over. And it's really fun because I get to hire my very talented musician friends. The latest record tie-in, The Sky Remains, features guitarist Anthony Wilson. He's an Angeleno himself, of course, the son of famed Gerald Wilson, who I'm a big fan of.
Let's check out an example of music that Josh Nelson has composed for his Discovery Project. From the album The Sky Remains on the Origin record label, here's a little bit of Bridges and Tunnels.
Discovery Project. It's constantly changing, so I'm looking to always bring in new components, new people, keep it moving.
Let's talk a little bit about your performance coming up in Fresno. You'll be performing with the Fresno City College large ensemble and also bringing your own group. Who's going to be joining you?
I have the pleasure of bringing up a very talented young saxophonist originally from Israel. His name is Daniel Rotem. He was in the Thelonious Monk Institute, now Herbie Hancock Institute, and still lives in Los Angeles, thankfully. And then a bassist from Adelaide, Australia, Anna Butters, very talented. And then my old friend Dan Schnell on drums, who I've been playing with for a long time. He's been on my last three albums. We'll be playing some selections of mine from those records. So you'll hear some music from Discovery Project, and then some music of Daniel's, and probably a couple of standard arrangements that I've been working on. And then I get to perform, or at least be a part of the ensemble performing two of my big band arrangements under the direction of Paul Lucchesi. So I'm really looking forward to that.
That will be fun to hear, too. I'm familiar with at least one of those tunes, and they're a lot of fun for a band to play and even more fun for an audience to listen to. Josh Nelson, thanks so much for joining us today. Josh Nelson with
his
group will be in performance this coming Thursday, 7:30 p.m. at Fresno City College as part of the 29th Annual City Jazz Festival. And if you want to get some more music education from him, he'll be giving a couple of clinics during the day on Thursday, March 21st.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. March is Women's History Month, and here at Valley Public Radio, we wanted to spend a part of it talking to women who are leaders here in the Central Valley. So with us in our studio today, we have Yasmin Mendoza, organizer of the Fresno Chapter of March for Our Lives and a youth organizer with the Dolores Huerta Foundation, Alexandria Ramos O'Casey, who most recently was a consultant on the campaign for Kingsburg City Council member Jewel Hurtado, and Kamal Carr, who is the Fresno County community organizer for the Jacara movement. Thanks to you all for being here in the first place.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Okay, so Yasmin, let's start with you. You were not involved in politics or organizing before the shooting at a high school in Parkland, Florida. That was just over a year ago now. After those student survivors started March for Our Lives, you decided Fresno needs its own gun violence movement. But what motivated you to say, I'm going to be the one to do it?
At first, I was really unsure if I wanted to join in and be loud about this issue because it's extremely controversial and it could really anger a lot of people. But from personal experience, for the first 12 years of my life, I grew up in a place where there was a lot of gun violence, and I felt that a lot of communities of color have always been overlooked. And so I definitely wanted to bring that voice to the table and really, you know, bring up the issue of gun violence in Fresno, especially, like I said, in communities of color.
And now that you're doing youth organizing with the Dolores Huerta Foundation, did you find something in organizing with March for Our Lives that made you say, I want to keep going?
Yes. I love talking to people and connecting with people and hearing their stories. I really believe that in order to get closer to the solutions, we need to get closer to the pain. And so a lot of people, there's a lot of pain. And I think that we really do need to listen to what people, the Hispanic community and Black community have to say about these issues, because I do feel like the solutions are there.
And Alex, you're on the other end of the spectrum. You have been involved in numerous campaigns and organizations now. So when you go out and talk to people about an issue or a candidate, how do you get them to become invested in what you're saying?
Yeah, for me, it's really just about keeping it real and keeping it honest. For them, I always try to keep it and bring it back to my roots as much as I possibly can. Like, all of my tias, all of my aunties on my mom's side of the family, they were all educators for the most part. So for me, it really just comes back to, what is the truth we're trying to find? How are we educating one another through story, through our personal experiences? And for me, that's really, I think, what allows me to be successful in my line of work, because I am honest and I bring it back to, you know, our roots and really the same, those same connections and the similarities that we have as people in the Valley.
And then Kamal, turning to you, so your work is primarily in the Sikh community, organizing youth volunteers, helping them get involved, civic engagement, things like that. And I'm wondering, do you find that the attention of political players and mass media just does turn to the Sikh community very often, or do they get skipped over? And, you know, how do you try to elevate those voices if you can?
Talking about mass media, I think in the past few years, we've seen that the way Sikh community has been portrayed is in a victim form, and we want to change that narrative, right? We're not only people who are attacked because of the way we identify or look, but we want to talk about, you know, all the good work and the players in the community that we are. And I think sometimes media misses that. So, you know, we're hoping to change that as well. And in the world of politics, I believe here locally, at least in Fresno, they are definitely looking at the Sikh Punjabi community that's here. You know, Punjabi is the fourth most spoken language here in Fresno County, and they know that we are a big, big part of this community. And that's my role as well, to elevate these voices, is to hopefully get all these youth to be civically involved and engaged. We work a lot with the youth, hoping that they can motivate their parents to be civically engaged, you know, to go out and do voter reg forms. To make sure their parents are voting, and to make sure, you know, if they need translation services, those kind of things are available. And those are kind of the work that we try to do to elevate their voices.
And then you were all women of color in your 20s. And so I'm curious, do people ever, you know, use your youth or your gender or ethnic identity maybe as a reason to doubt you, or, you know, ask, what do you know? You look like a young person. And how do you steer around that? Kamal, you're nodding. I don't know. Do you have an answer?
Well, I could speak to that because so the work we do at the Jagada Movement is very new for the community that I work with. There was no such thing as community organizing in our realm and the population I work with. So usually it used to be these uncles or older men who usually took charge, talked to the politicians, got people to be engaged. So when they do see the youth being involved, or young women like me especially, being involved, they look at me like, oh, you're just a little girl, like, oh, you're, yeah, okay, they'll, like, you know, nod along. But it's sometimes the voices aren't taken as seriously as I'm hoping. But, you know, I'm making my way through, getting through to them, building those relationships, and slowly changing their minds.
Alex or Yasmin, what about you? Have you experienced that?
Absolutely. Every day. Every day. But especially when it comes to politics and community organizing, it's kind of its own brand, because it's like everyone either is representing that they do have that same goal, that they want us to be equal to them, or we want to achieve equity. But, you know, some people are still struggling to get there. And it kind of makes it that much harder sometimes to accept as someone who's trying to promote change as a young woman of color, because you're just like, well, you know, we're voicing that we want the same and we have the same goals. But somehow when we're having community meetings, like, there's still a lot of disrespect happening. That's very obvious, you know. Just things like that that happen all the time. And I think it's a matter of making sure that we're comfortable saying this isn't okay, and this is why it isn't okay, and this is how we need to change that.
I'm in the same boat. I think that it's very common. Sometimes I think women have a really good intuition, you know, about things. And sometimes you might not hear it, but you could definitely sense it. You can definitely sense that, you know, it feels a little off, where perhaps, you know, they're nodding their heads, but you can really feel that, you know, they're not really taking you seriously. And even, you know, here in the Central Valley, most of the, you know, city council and on the board of supervisors, it's really all men. We have one woman, and that's Esmeralda Soria.
On the city council,
On the city council, right. And it's pretty obvious here that in the Central Valley, it doesn't feel like women in leadership positions is necessarily totally welcomed just yet.
I'm curious, is that something then that, it sounds like that's a concern for you, Yasmin, is that something that in your kind of different realms you guys are hoping to, I don't know, move towards, maybe working, maybe Alex, for you, working on a campaign for a woman, or I don't know if you guys do a lot of, you mentioned civic engagement, but just like campaign work specifically, Kamal?
So I actually sit on the Commission for Status of Women for the county. And just even seeing how that commission is treated compared to other commissions that we do have here locally, it's really surprising, because this commission, the Status of Women Commission, used to be funded once upon a time by the city, and then the funding got cut. And now it's given to the county, but even the lack of resources that we receive are so limited. So I definitely agree with you there that I believe, yeah, women aren't taken as seriously in those large official roles.
Yeah, and I think that's something that really just became such a constant concern so consistently, to the point that I think for me this last election cycle, I was just like, okay, well, do I want to work on another big campaign, or do we want to build something that's something really true to us and something that really represents, you know, young people and young people of color in these particular areas? And so for me, it was like, well, you know, if they keep telling us, right, like, don't reinvent the wheel, but I'm like, we keep getting run over by the wheel. So I think maybe we do have to, you know, make a different wheel. And that's kind of how I saw my role in helping Jewel get elected this time around was, you know, they weren't going to give it to us. So we decided to take the seat.
I want to ask you all, who is a woman who inspires you? Yasmin, do you want to start?
Mine's Dolores Huerta. I mean, I work for her foundation, so maybe I'm a little biased, but maybe. But yeah, she really has inspired me from a young age. She was the negotiator in a lot of the deals going on with the farm workers, you know, the union and the strikes. She was the negotiator, and I feel like negotiators are usually the backbone of the movement. And I feel like she definitely was overlooked a lot, even to this day. A lot of people don't know who she is. And for me, she really has been a very huge motivator and just inspiration on the type of person that, you know, I want to be, or the way that I want to serve my community. She's very, just so selfless. She really is so selfless and just full of power, and I feel it. You know, every time I'm with her, I just feel it. You know, she's 88 years old and still going, and I hope I'm doing that when I'm 88. So
awesome. Alex, what about you?
My mother. Yeah. My mother for sure. And I had kind of thought about, you know, some other famous women, but I think for me it really just comes back to my mom, because I think I realized too that all the women that are famous that she taught me about, you know, I wouldn't have known about them without her, right? So my mom, you know, she's been an educator here in the Valley pretty much her entire life when she finished her degrees. And she really just gives back to the community in as many ways as she can. And really, you know, I think for me, it's just always been a perfect example of, you know, being a hard worker and really putting social interest in your community first. So for me, it's my mom. Yeah.
And Kamal, what about you?
These are all such great women. I mean, these, you know, my mother, of course, is a huge inspiration to me as well. And Dolores Huerta, I saw her documentary and I was like, oh my God, she's amazing, right? But I have to say, the new freshman congresswomen that came in have been an inspiration to me, especially AOC, right? A woman from Bronx, and the way she speaks up, she's our age, she's relatable, and I'm just in such awe of her and a fangirl, right? So I hope to meet her one day. But yeah, she's definitely someone who inspires me currently.
The last thing I want to ask is, people have called 2018 Year of the Woman. There were so many women, as you've just mentioned, who ran for office, who did take office. And while you three aren't running for office, you're very involved in your specific communities. And I want to ask, maybe what are you hearing about what 2020 might become? And not thinking too much about the presidential election, but, you know, is it going to be the year of historically marginalized groups rising up, of actual gender parity? What do you think?
I think it's going to be a year where people really are coming into their own and feeling comfortable sharing their stories in a way that is effective, in a way that is strategic, in a way that spreads a fire and sparks energy in other people. And that's what I'm most excited to see, is people just, you know, not only working through the trauma, working through the beauty of just all of the different experiences we've had, but just like owning their stories and doing it in a way that allows us to feel comfortable owning our stories as well.
I think since I, you know, have the great pleasure of working with the youth and seeing them grow and them being so, so, so involved in politics and actually caring, you know, compared to what the usual thought is that the youth don't care, they don't want to vote, which isn't true, right? We see that they want to vote, they want to create change. And I'm really, really excited for the year 2020 when these 16, 17-year-olds are going to be old enough to vote, and they are going to be that new change and the wave. And I'm very, very hopeful for 2020.
I honestly think it's going to be the year of community organizers. I feel that, you know, in the upcoming, in 2020, the next presidential election, a lot of these people need to have community organizers at the top, listening to them, because they really are the ones who know the people on the ground the best. They really do understand the issues on the ground. And I really do feel that this next year, and even this year, it is really the year of the community organizers.
Okay, that's all the time we have to discuss, but we've been speaking to Yasmin Mendoza, Alexandria Ramos-Ocasey, and Kamal Carr. They are leaders and community organizers here in the San Joaquin Valley. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org, or download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio, and on Twitter at KVPR.
Did you know we have an app? It's called KVPR, and it's available for free in app stores on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by our news director, Alice Daniel, and reporters Carrie Klein and Monica Velez.
And reporter Laura Satsui. Our audio engineer is Marv Allen, and Don Weaver is our production and operations manager. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Laura Satsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2020 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.